Welcome to the Fitness FAQs podcast, where we learn from the smartest people in the world. I'm your host, Daniel Vadnall, a physio from Australia with more than 15 years of calisthenics experience. Jeremy Etier is the brains behind Built With Science, teaching an evidence-based approach to training and nutrition. His YouTube channel has over 5 million subscribers and is one of the most trusted resources online. So today we're going to get into some myth-busting topics concerning training, nutrition, and also body composition. To start with, is it possible for everyone to build muscle and lose fat at the same time?
Yeah. So what you're referring to is body recomposition. And typically there's like two camps of people. There's one camp who think like it's totally impossible to build muscle and lose fat at the same time. And there's another camp that thinks it's a lot easier to do than it actually is. And the truth is, body recomposition, building muscle, losing fat, it's definitely possible, and we've seen that quite a bit in the research, but it depends on the certain individual, and it also depends on your ability to execute the proper training and nutrition plan to actually favor body recomposition. And let's first start with what are the groups that are most likely to experience a body recomposition. So if you think about it, building muscle, losing fat, those are two opposing goals. So the groups who are most likely to be able to build muscle and lose fat tend to be groups where they have a higher capacity to build muscle. So these are beginners who haven't really had much weight training experience, and they'll build muscle relatively quickly once they start lifting weights. These are also detrained individuals. So if you're somebody who has lifted weights in the past but stopped for whatever reason, you now have a higher ability to rebuild that muscle once you start lifting weights. And then the third group would be somebody who has never really optimized their training and nutrition. So let's say somebody who, you know, has been kind of half-assing in the gym. As soon as they start like actually training hard and following a proper diet, they're most likely to experience a body recomposition. And then the last group is actually those who are higher in body fat. So I'd say anything, you know, above maybe 20%, maybe even above 15%. That's where you're a little bit more likely to be able to accomplish both, because your body has so much excess energy stored as fat that it can pull from in order to support muscle recovery and growth. So generally, if you fall within one of those four categories, then body recomposition is likely to occur. But the second part of that is it also depends on it also requires you to follow the right plan. So when it comes to your training, like it's pretty simple. You got to lift weights and you got to push yourself hard, and you got to be trying to do a little bit more every week in terms of progressive overload, because that's what's going to send the muscle building stimulus. The real key though is it comes with nutrition. So to accomplish a body recomp, you want to eat enough calories so that you're able to, your muscles are able to recover and grow, but you also need to be in a slight deficit so that your body is actually going to be able to lose fat, right? But the key is that the deficit can't be too large. If it is too large, then your body's not going to have enough resources and nutrients to be able to rebuild and grow more muscle. So generally, what I'd recommend is anywhere between a 5 to 20% deficit under your maintenance calories. So for most people, that's around 100 to a max of 500 calories under the deficit. That seems to be the sweet spot. And then the second thing in terms of your diet is you need to make sure that you're having enough protein. There's been a handful of studies that have compared high protein intakes with low protein intakes, and it's consistently shown that the higher protein intake group, they are able to actually build muscle and lose fat at the same time, whereas the low protein group, they lose a similar amount of weight, but they're not actually able to build muscle, and less of that weight that they lose is fat. So high protein intake, I'd say like anywhere around 1 gram per pound of body weight is a good number to hit. And that's kind of like the protocol to achieve a body recomposition. But that being said, like, I think If you're outside of the groups that I mentioned, trying to build muscle and lose fat at the same time, like it's tough, and most likely you're going to be spinning your wheels. So I would say, like, for the majority of people who are outside those categories that I mentioned, you'll be far better off just prioritizing one goal over the other.
For sure. Given that recomposition strategy with calorie intake around maintenance deficit is going to be a slower process, as you said, it just seems so much more efficient and effective to be focusing on being on a surplus, to be able to have the building blocks of building muscle, or if you're trying to lose fat, having that as a separate goal at a later period of time with a calorie deficit is going to help you achieve that in a quicker way. Is there anyone in particular that you recommend this body recomposition for?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, like if you are somebody who falls into the groups that I mentioned earlier, that would be a good idea. And typically, like if you're seeking to build muscle and lose fat, I would say that the most common body type that wants to do this is somebody who has that skinny fat body type. So if you do have that skinny fat body type and you do fall in one of those categories I mentioned, then it probably is a good idea. But at the same time, even if you're within those categories, the results can be slow. I think when most people think of, like, I'm going to lose fat and build muscle at the same time, they're like, I'm going to look amazing in 6 weeks or even 12 weeks, right? But the truth is, like, the results can be really slow, and it can play tricks in your mind, because if your weight isn't changing at all, you have to look at a lot of other metrics and variables to determine if you're actually making progress. So while it can definitely be beneficial for certain populations, it is a tricky area to navigate.
What measurements in terms of body composition or training measurements would you be focused on for someone that does want to rebody composition?
Yeah, so the main things that I would look at, and the main things we get our members to look at, are you would look at your weight, and your weight should remain, pretty much the same. It might decrease a little bit, it might increase a little bit, nothing crazy. But you should also be measuring your waist circumference. So the goal is that your waist circumference is remaining the same, or the goal is that your waist circumference is decreasing, and other measurements of, let's say, your arms, your chest, your shoulders, so muscle measurements, those are increasing. While also your strength in the gym, you want to see that increase in as well. So for example, if my body weight has stayed the same and my strength has increased in the gym and my waist circumference has decreased, those are very obvious signs that yes, I am indeed building muscle and losing fat at the same time, and I should continue what I'm doing. So those would probably be the key things that I would definitely measure.
Now, with respect to fat loss, is it possible to spot reduce fat in a certain area? For men, it's very common to store excess adipose tissue or fat on the stomach. Is it possible to selectively choose where on your body you want to lose fat?
Yeah, so as much as we'd like to believe that doing exercises that work a specific area will lead to the body favoring fat loss from that area, it just doesn't seem very promising. And as far as the evidence in the literature, like, there really hasn't been anything that has shown that. And if it has, it's been relatively insignificant or inconsistent in the research. So long story short, no. But I do think one thing that is extremely underrated, specifically when it comes to the belly, is training your abs. And not training your abs like the typical way that people do, a set of crunches and body weight, oh, it burns, I'm gonna stop. But training your abs like you would any other muscle, right? So weighted ab training, applying progressive overload, doing more reps, doing more weight with your abs. And this is because research has shown that the abs can actually hypertrophy and gain size and thickness just as well as other muscles do, right? As long as we train them just like we do other muscles. And the benefit of that is that even if you're at a relatively higher body fat percentage, training and growing your abs might help them stick out and protrude a little bit more. So your abs might look a little bit better, even though you haven't lost all of your belly fat. And this is actually, I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of CrossFitters and strongman competitors, they have like really visible and well-defined cores, even though they're at a relatively higher body fat percentage. And even just like speaking anecdotally, like for myself, once I started really prioritizing like weighted abs training, that's when I really started to see like my abs develop, and now they're like quite visible even when I'm at a relatively higher body fat percentage. So I do think like that's definitely an underrated way to improve ab development. But at the same time, like if you're 20-25% body fat with a lot of fat on your belly, like regardless of how much weighted ab training you do, if you don't get rid of that fat, then you're not going to be able to see them.
I agree 100% with the fact that the ab muscles have potential for hypertrophy and can definitely increase their size, just like any other muscle group. Sometimes I feel that the abs, in addition to the calves, those two areas are just kind of just negated as areas of the body that don't respond to hypertrophy, muscle building principles like every other muscle group. But I have a theory regarding why there's the misconception about ab training will give you abs and it will shred off belly fat. Most people will start training their abs whilst they simultaneously go on a deficit and lose fat. So there tends to be this correlation with ab exercises gives me six-pack visible abs. But it's, as we know from basic science, correlation doesn't always equal causation. So it's important people understand that doing these ab exercises won't magically get rid of all that fat on your stomach, but doing the ab exercises will increase the size, where if you are at a point where you're lean enough to see the abs, it's arguable that your ab muscles will pop more by the combination of their increased size and being a leaner person.
Exactly, 100%.
Now, with cardio, this is another common area that is used to lose weight, get leaner. There's this misconception that fasted cardio is superior to fed cardio. Is there any truth to this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's funny because like before I started diving into the science and putting out videos and whatnot, like that was one of the protocols that I like firmly believed in and stuck to. It was like, okay, I wanted to lose fat, specifically like stubborn fat. I always did cardio in a fasted state. But now, thankfully, you know, I've learned that the answer is actually, you know, it's yes and no. So what I mean is that during any exercise, your body will burn a mix of fats and carbs for energy. Now, when you're fasted and you haven't eaten anything, your body will prefer to use fats for energy. So if you did a fasted cardio workout, your body would technically use more fats for energy, right? Compared to if you were fed, you had eaten before that cardio session, your body would prefer to use carbs for energy rather than fats. So within that session, if you were fasted, you would burn more fats than carbs. But the thing is, and the thing that most people overlook, is that after that session, your body actually compensates by burning more carbs for energy as opposed to fats. So the net effect at the end of the day is really zero. Like it's the same regardless if you do fasted versus fed. And there's been plenty of studies, new studies on this as well. And basically just showing that like calorie, your energy balance at the end of the day is what matters the most.
And we should also include here the personal preference aspect. So if someone absolutely despises doing fed cardio, they feel sluggish, they feel it's really laborious and they don't enjoy it at all. So as a result, they're like, nah, I'm just going to not do cardio. Whereas if they enjoy doing fasted cardio, they feel light, their adherence is really good, then you could say, given that both are net equal in terms of the effect on body composition, if calories are matched, etc., this is where we've really got to recommend, and I'm sure you do the same, Jeremy, with it's got to be down to what the person enjoys, given two styles of doing something are relatively similar.
Exactly. And yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because like, just because fasted cardio isn't superior to fed cardio doesn't mean that it may not be a good idea for certain people. Like for me, example, as you mentioned, if I eat, you know, a big meal before I do cardio, like I do feel sluggish, and I prefer in most cases to do cardio still in a fasted state, not because I think it'll burn more fat, but just because like I prefer it and it fits my routine a lot better. So yeah, that's a really good point.
For sure. And you hear often it's a really good way of including it into your schedule. A lot of people find success with first thing in the morning, fasted cardio, and then doing their resistance training later in the day when they're going to be able to perform optimally. So it comes down to how it structures into your routine and habit when the big picture is considered. There's this myth that delayed onset muscle soreness, feeling sore in your muscles after a workout, is a good indicator of a successful workout. Do we need to be sore for a workout to be successful?
So yeah, that's definitely a big misconception. And long story short, soreness is not directly correlated with growth, and it's not necessary for growth to occur. There's plenty of ways to get a muscle really sore without making it actually grow. But what I do think soreness is good for is, for example, I think in general, after a workout, the next day or two, like your muscles should experience like some level of soreness. Over time, of course, it's going to die down, but I think some level of soreness is a good indication that you pushed hard enough and worked the right muscles. And I also think soreness is a really good indicator of if you worked the right muscles. For example, if you were doing bench press in a workout and the next day you wake up and you have little to no soreness in your chest and all the soreness is in your front delts, that's a pretty good indication that maybe you compromised on your form and you weren't activating the right muscles. So I think that like soreness in general, I wouldn't obsess over it and think that if I'm not sore, I'm not going to grow. As long as you are progressive overloading over time and sticking to the basics, that's going to help you grow regardless of the soreness. But I do think at the same time, soreness does provide some helpful feedback for your workouts in the cases that I mentioned.
Definitely. And just to give some examples of things that would make your muscles sore, we're talking eccentric based movements like Romanian deadlifts, things involving a very heavy stretch. If you're doing a sudden increase in your training volume or intensity, is likely to do it as well. If you're doing new and novel exercises, these are also things that are going to make you sore. And I just want to agree with what you're saying there. The idea of progressive overload should be a priority for naturals, because we know that if you're doing a workout program, you're following it and you're progressing. Over time, thanks to the repeated bout effect, your body gets used to the stimulus. So even though you're pushing yourself, you're doing more reps, you're doing more sets, you're doing more weight, and you're not feeling sore, it's because your body is experiencing that repeated bout effect. And it's important that you don't feel insecure that you're not training really hard or, you know, causing a lot of damage and just having that excruciating soreness that you did at the start. It's not a sign that your program isn't working. It's just that your body's getting accustomed to what you're doing.
Exactly. And I think, as you mentioned, like a lot of people, as soon as they stop feeling that soreness that they did initially, they take it as a sign that what they're doing is no longer working, whereas in reality it's often the very opposite of that.
How would you intelligently incorporate variety into a routine?
That's a really good question, and it is very individual. And it also depends on your goals, like whether it's strength related or more hypertrophy related. I think like a general rule of thumb is if things are stagnant and you haven't been progressing for some time and you've been using the same routine for, I don't know, at least 6 to 8 weeks, that may be a good time to look at routine and say, Like what can I change up to provide a little bit of a different stimulus? Whether it could even just be switching the order of the exercises, switching some of the rep ranges, or, you know, introducing new exercises. But I think it definitely should be done sparingly. And another reason that you would change things up is, you know, injuries, aches or pains from doing the same movements over and over again. That's when it's a really good sign. It's literally your body telling you that you need to change things up. You're overusing the same joints or muscles way too often. But yeah.
Well said. I think that definition of time-based recommendation for variety is absolutely key. And if people were to follow that, I feel there'd be a lot of success to be had. I'll just add with the variety piece, I like to keep the majority of the compound lifts the same because there's a skill component. You're trying to progress that in a patient way. With isolation movements, there's a little bit more leeway for variety, I feel, because it's a bit more of a non-specific outcome that you're achieving in a sense. Like so many ways to isolate the bicep, so many ways to isolate the tricep. And I feel that introducing some variety with isolation at a higher frequency keeps people engaged. It keeps them adhering to their program, but they're still taking care of that big piece, which is their compounds.
Exactly. And that's like pretty much how I program my own training as well. And you also brought up a good point as well, which is like, you don't just want to consider like what is optimal in terms of, you know, gains and strength. You also need to look at the actual individual. Are they still like excited and interested to do their workouts? Or are they bored and just like totally bored of doing the same thing over and over again? Because like what's more important than everything that we talked about is just consistency and showing up into your workouts. So I think that should definitely like be placed as a priority when it comes to programming.
Now, the other myth I'd like to touch on is the idea that compound exercises are all you need to build a physique and isolation exercises aren't necessary. What do you think about that?
I think that compound exercises generally are great because, you know, they're efficient. They work multiple muscle groups at the same time and they often, you know, challenge them very well. But they do have their limitations. Many times compound exercises will work a variety of muscles, you know, well, but not as good as it could be with an isolation exercise. And in some instances, certain muscles, if you only use compound exercises, you would be neglecting certain heads of that muscle. For example, let's look at the hamstrings. So some of the hamstring muscles, they work to extend the hip. So this is where compound exercises like deadlifts, these would train these certain hamstring muscles quite well. Whereas the other hamstring muscles, they work to flex the knee, right? And you wouldn't be able to train and grow them as well as you could be if you only did deadlifts, because these muscles require an exercise that challenges them with knee flexion, such as a leg curl. So that's when combining, you know, a hip extension movement like a deadlift with something like a leg curl, that's what's like required if you want to optimally train and grow that muscle. And on a similar note for the upper body, there was actually a study that was published not too long ago, and they had one group of subjects just do the bench press, and they had another group did bench press plus an overhead triceps extension. So the bench press group, they had good chest gains and good overall triceps gains as well. But one of the heads, which is actually the biggest head of the triceps, the long head, that head did not grow. It barely grew for just the bench press alone group. Whereas the bench press plus the overhead tricep extension, they saw significantly more growth in the long head. So it's another case of like, if you only did compounds, you'd be training, you know, a lot of your muscles pretty well and they would grow pretty well from it, but you'd be missing out on these select few cases that honestly makes a big difference in terms of a well-balanced, well-developed physique.
And also from a stimulus to fatigue perspective, we know that compound exercises are king. They serve the majority of your strength and muscle building to a point. Everything has an element of diminishing returns. after you've done your several sets of a squat, if you're subscribing to the idea that compounds are all you need, you'd have to keep doing more sets of squats to get enough sets in to hit the minimum threshold of volume that we recommend for hypertrophy. So it just makes sense to fill in the missing pieces from a stimulus to fatigue perspective, but also a what is actually missing from the compound exercises. Because with the compounds, you're targeting multiple muscle groups. There's only going to be like one or two that legitimately gets exhausted to the threshold that we need to stimulate strength and muscle building. So the isolation, in addition to that, as you said, is really going to help.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point.
How about the idea that squats and deadlifts are a testosterone boosting exercise? And if you do squats and deadlifts, your test levels in your body will be like supercharged. And the fact that by doing that, your whole potential for muscle growth in your body increases. Is there tangible proof of this? Should we worry about it?
There is actually proof of it. But as with many things, there's a catch. And it's funny because like this was another one of those things where when I was younger, first started training, like I heard all the time and I thought was just fact. And it was probably just like all placebo, but I could literally feel my testosterone just raging after like a set of
maybe it was how old you were as well. That's a potential yeah, piece.
Exactly. But yeah, and the reason I say there's some truth to this is because yes, we do see an increase in testosterone, but it's only acutely, right? It's only I believe only a few hours or maybe even less than that. So it's only centered around your workouts, and if in order to build more muscle from an increase in testosterone, that increase has to be chronic and it has to be sustained day after day after day. So while testosterone will increase, you know, acutely during and around that workout, it's not sustained, and therefore the effect that it would have on actual building muscle would be, I would say, like very, very, very minimal to nothing. Nothing significant, and nothing like worth actually, you know, worrying about. And it's funny because like a lot of other things, they will acutely increase your testosterone as well. For example, I can't remember this one study, but I believe it was like speaking to an attractive girl, it boosted like testosterone just spiked way up. But again, it was just acutely. Whereas actually if you were in the same room with a girl who was crying, that actually did the opposite effect and it decreased testosterone, which is pretty funny. But again, these are just acute effects. Like it's not going to have any meaningful impact on muscle growth because it doesn't stay day after day after day. I think like the only things naturally that you should be worried about in order to increase testosterone chronically day after day after day would be the basics, just getting enough sleep, making sure you're within a healthy range of body fat, not too low, but also not too high. And just eating, you know, eating a well-balanced diet and making sure you can exercise. So it's really just the basics.
Unfortunately, most of us are intelligent and aware enough to understand that the basics are the biggest levers that you can pull for increasing testosterone. But they're also the hardest to do on an ongoing basis. It's like, it is difficult to continually get your sleep in, continually eat diverse set of nutrients, micros, macros, and be doing that consistently day after day. I think that we love this fitness stuff and sometimes we geek out on what is like the little thing that we can do. And we lose sight of just, if we're just worried about those key things, our testosterone levels would be much higher than if we were concerned about, oh, we have to do squats or deadlifts because it was said to increase testosterone.
Exactly, yeah.
And I'm sure with the notion of squats and deadlifts increasing testosterone, surely that acute effect is experienced on other major compound lifts as well. Like if you're doing heavy leg presses, I'd be hard-pressed to believe that that's not also increasing your test levels too.
Yeah, I'd actually be interested. I I haven't really looked into the research into that too much to see if they have tested like different CrossFit exercises. I think squats and deadlifts are the most commonly tested in studies, but that would definitely be interesting, or maybe even like an isolation movement might even have a similar effect.
This episode is sponsored by Fitness FAQs. Become a bodyweight beast with our calisthenics workouts. Use the coupon code PODCAST10 at checkout to save 10% off when shopping at fitnessfaqs.com. Don't miss this discount. Start training smarter and enjoy the gains. With regard to building muscle, what is the optimal amount of sets that we should be doing to build muscle and hypertrophy?
Yeah, so this is an interesting area of research, and it's something that I think we're going to see changes and develops quite a bit in the next few years. I think generally, like, the good, decent rule of thumb is somewhere between 10 sets per muscle per week, somewhere between 10 to 20 sets per muscle per week. That's generally a good range. And some people say, you know, beginners should stay at the lower end of that range, and then maybe as you get more intermediate or advanced, you should move up towards, you know, maybe closer to the 20 set per muscle per week group. I honestly think it depends. There's a lot of variability. I think the research generally has shown that if you increase your volume relative to what you have always been doing and what you've been doing for a while, typically we see an increase in growth as a response to that. But now, after that increase, you're at this new baseline. Then, in order for future growth to occur, you most likely have to increase that even further. And you can only do that up to a certain point, right? And this seems to be maybe around 20 sets per muscle per group. So I think that's where the idea of like volume cycling comes into play and can be helpful, especially as you get more intermediate and advanced, where, you know, you're slowly ramping up volume, and then maybe you take a deload or recovery week, whatever you want to call it, before you kind of repeat that cycle. I think generally between 10 to 20 sets per muscle per week is a good range to shoot for. But I also think that, you know, with some new research that is coming out, it seems that what's even more important than volume is the intensity, the effort that you're putting into those sets. Because it seems like, you know, maybe 10 sets that are done really hard, done, you know, within 1 to 2 reps short of failure, is probably going to be a lot better than, you know, 15, maybe even 20 sets done that are, you know, you stopped well before the set reached actual failure. So I think that, like, what we will see is that maybe a little bit less volume is optimal, but given that those sets are pushed really hard and close enough or to failure.
Definitely. And I feel that the pendulum swings to extremes. We have the camp that does the high intensity training, very minimal sets per muscle group per session, just absolute brutal intensity to failure, beyond failure, making just a few sets or even one set really count. Or you get the opposite camp, who's just doing extreme volume. They're doing 20 to 30 sets per workout, not per week, on chest day. And as we understand with fitness, it's the in between is really key, and getting within that 10 to 20 and cycling, as you said, the volume, I think, are absolutely great strategies for long-term success. And I'll just add as well that not all sets are equal. And what I mean by that is, if we're doing sets of Romanian deadlifts, it absolutely exhausts you if you're training close to failure. Whereas if you're doing a back extension, you could do double the amount of sets and feel the same amount of quote-unquote fatigue from that amount of work. So we just need to be marrying up the notion of the amount of quality sets is important, the stimulus and difficulty of the exercise, whether it's compound isolation, matters, and trying to find that sweet spot for you is really key.
Exactly, and that's a really good point as well, is It also heavily depends on the individual, because a lot of people, they need to remind themselves that your workouts throughout the week aren't the only thing that your body and your mind has to recover from. Like, there's life stressors, there's your work, there's your relationships that your body and your mind has to recover from. So what may be optimal in terms of volume for somebody else or somebody in this research study may not be optimal for you. So at the end of the day, you really have to experiment with it, and you have to see, you have to listen to your body and listen to it when it's telling you you're doing too much. Or also, on the other hand, listen to your body and know when it's giving you the signals that, yes, I can do a little bit more, and that's probably going to be better for growth.
When it comes to specifically building muscle, heavy weights versus light weights, what is better for muscle growth?
Yeah, so one of the big ideas that's been around for a while is the idea that lower reps of, let's say, anything under 6 reps, so let's say 3 to 5 reps, that's best for strength. Whereas the hypertrophy rep range of, you know, some people say 6 to 12 or 8 to 15, that's best for building muscle. Whereas anything above that, that's seen as muscle endurance, and not so good for building muscle. And in the past 5 to 10 years, there's been a lot of studies that have disproved that and shown that you can build muscle across all of these rep ranges, as long as you're pushing close enough to failure and as long as volume is similar across those groups. Now, this is good because it means that, let's say you're somebody who is limited on weights or equipment and you don't have the option to just lift more weight and stick within, you know, let's say 8 to 12 reps. So this means that instead of increasing weight, you could just continue increasing your reps and build the same amount of muscle that you would if you were to use heavier weights. So that's a bonus. But the catch is that there comes a point where the weight just gets too light, where it's now suboptimal for building muscle. And this seems to be around 30% of your one rep max of an exercise. So let's say you could do, I don't know, bench press for 100 pounds. If you, 100 pounds for one rep, that would be a one rep max. So if you used a weight that was, you know, 30 pounds or lighter, that would be too light for growth. But I do think people have to keep in mind that there's also downsides to using these different rep ranges when it comes to building muscle, right? So if all you did was those higher rep ranges, like, it's extremely uncomfortable. I don't know if you've ever done a set of squats that are over, even anything over like 15 reps. Like, that's tough. That's brutal. And the key with these higher rep ranges is that you, in order to experience the same growth, you have to be pushing close enough to failure. And that is extremely uncomfortable, anything over 15 plus reps. And then on the other end of the spectrum, if you only did lower reps with heavier weight, so let's say 3 to 5 reps, you'd have to do a lot of sets in order to match the volume that you would get from using the hypertrophy rep range. You could do it, but it would just take a lot longer and it would be pretty fatiguing, and you might experience some aches and pains in your joints after doing that for a while. So, to be honest, I think the most efficient rep range to build muscle is indeed that hypertrophy rep range of, let's say, 6 to 12 reps, just because, you know, it's the most, I guess, comfortable rep range when it comes to lifting weights, and it's the most time efficient, and it's just the most efficient in general. But I think that people have to keep in mind that you're not limited to just that, and there may be a benefit in doing a little bit of the higher rep range, a little bit of the lower rep range, especially when it comes to strength for the lower rep range.
Most definitely. And we also have to think of the safety topic. It's probably the least sexy aspect of training that people don't talk about, but it is important. The whole idea of minimizing and mitigating your injury risk. As you said, if someone's doing a set of 20 reps on the squat, you've got the cardiorespiratory stress, you've got the metabolic fatigue, you've got the skill and balance involved of balancing the barbell amidst all of that stress that's happening. debatable that it's safer to be doing a set of 6 to 12 reps on the squat. And conversely, same thing with isolation. Why in the world would you be doing sets of 6 reps on a leg extension or a hamstring curl? It's a lot of focal stress to the muscle. But if you're subscribing to the idea that you just have to do 6 to 30 reps for muscle building, you'd be doing high rep squats and low rep leg extensions. But this is where we need to use some common sense with what we're doing.
Exactly. And there may actually be a benefit of, you know, varying your rep ranges at least a little bit throughout your workout, because if you only did 6 to 12 reps for all exercises, you might be missing out on some growth or at least a different stimulus on your muscles that you would get with a little bit lower reps and a little bit higher reps. So I think like a good mix of all of that is great, but I think the majority, if your goal is to build muscle, the majority of your sets should be within that sweet spot of around 6 to 12 reps.
100%. And that was probably the most liberating realization that I had when I was reading the research about if the goal is hypertrophy, the effort relative to failure should be right at the top. The rep range constraints are there, but you've got so much more freedom with using heavier or lighter loads to accomplish that effect. And I just wanted to ask you as well, with the idea of free weights versus machines, how does this come into the equation? Because we've got some people who are adamant that free weights are superior to machines. What do you think?
Yeah, so there was a study done on this fairly recently, and they compared the muscle building effects of free weights versus machines, and they found that muscle growth was similar across both. So it seems like, you know, the muscle growth response that you would get is pretty similar, but I think it also depends. And again, there's pros and cons to both. The pros of the free weights is that, you know, a lot of the exercises that are free weight based, they really help work on your stability, your balance, and they might work, you know, some of your stabilizer muscles a little bit better than machines do. If all you did was machine work, then all your stabilizers generally are taken care of. So you might miss out on that aspect. But that's not to say that you could only do, you know, machines and add some additional, you know, stabilizer work to work on those muscles. And there's also, you know, a benefit in using machines. You know, sometimes, again, if your goal is to maximize muscle growth, then there are instances where you want to be as stable as possible so that you can work that target muscle as efficiently as possible. For example, hack squat, that's a really good example. You know, if you never really felt your legs give out first during a barbell squat, and maybe it's your lower back or your core, then try doing a set of hack squats, and believe me, if you push that close enough to failure, like, you'll feel your quads light up like never before. So there are instances where I think machines can come into play. Also, it totally depends on the individual and your goals. And I will say that even though the study found that building muscle was similar from free weights versus machines, strength was not. And that makes sense, because if you're doing a bench press, you're going to practice that skill and you're going to be a really good bencher. Versus if you only did, like, let's say a chest press machine, that's not going to transfer as well in terms of bench press strength. So in terms of like strength for the big lifts, then obviously it's like you'd want to stick to doing those free weights. But when it comes to building muscle, there's tons of flexibility, but I think it's not one or the other. Like, you should definitely mix in both into your routine.
And the way that I recommend this in a practical way for people to apply to their training is if they want to improve a specific exercise, put it at the start of your workout where you can refine the skill of the movement, progressively overload, build all those really specific neurological patterns. And then afterwards, you can get into some more of your machine work where you don't have to worry so much about stability, and you can really just focus on pushing yourself relative to failure, progressively overloading. And then I feel that gives you the best of both worlds, the strength-focused outcomes that you desire, in addition to augmenting your progress with hypertrophy stimulus that's super targeted with machines.
No, yeah, exactly. And again, that's like a similar approach that I take with my own program and program for clients as well. So, yeah.
So when taking time off the gym for whatever reason, through injury or holiday or just taking a break, what do we lose faster? Is it muscle size or strength?
So this is a bit of a tricky question because it depends on what you define as muscle size. But generally, you do lose strength faster than actual muscle. And this is because, again, strength is a skill. If you're not practicing those movements, then you're going to lose strength on them very fast, quicker than you would actual muscle. And the reason I said it depends on what you classify as muscle size is because if you stop training, then, you know, as little as a week, 2 weeks, even within 3 weeks, you're going to lose a lot of glycogen and water from your muscles. So the literal size of them will reduce, and you'll probably notice that. But in terms of actual muscle loss, it's going to be pretty minimal. And we don't actually see actual muscle loss from detraining until, you know, at least around 3 weeks. So I think, like, a lot of people, when they take time off from the gym, that initial, like, reduction in size that they get really worried about, it's not actual muscle. So you can rest assured it's not actual muscle unless, you know, you stop training for several weeks on end. And the other thing is that regaining strength, since you lose strength faster, it's actually a lot faster to regain strength than it is to regain size. But at the same time, regaining muscle size, because of muscle memory, it's a lot faster to regain muscle than it took you to initially build that muscle. But you will regain strength a lot faster than you will rebuild muscle, which will also be faster than the time it took you to build that muscle in the first place.
Right. What is the reason that muscle grows quicker if you've trained previously compared to someone that's never lifted before?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And to be honest, I would assume it's because, you know, the cells in your muscle have you know, been hypertrophied. And I think it probably has to do with, you know, just that memory within the cell that it's been there before, and it'll remember how to do that as long as you provide that stimulus going forward. But to be honest, that's a really good question. I'd have to look into that a little bit more.
For sure. In addition to that, I feel that there's the dormant neurological pathways that have been trained. A great example we can give is if someone has learned how to ride a bike when they were younger, if you didn't ride a bike for 10 years, when you get back on, you're going to be a little bit shaky, but after a little bit of practice, you'll be able to ride the bike fine. Compared to when you were a child learning how to ride a bike, it took you longer, a lot more practice. A bro science analogy, if you will, how that translates to the fitness stuff is you've done overhead press before, you've done squats before, you've done horizontal pressing, etc. You'll be a little bit shaky at the start, but it's there. It's neurologically there at your level of your central nervous system. So that combined with the dormant muscle cells, I feel that combination makes it quicker for someone to retrain as opposed to someone that's just starting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Now, say someone is going on a holiday and they don't want to stick to their normal routine of, say, 5 days a week. What would be the minimum amount of work you'd recommend to, quote unquote, maintain their level of size and strength?
That's a really good question. And I would say that, you know, based on the research, it seems that you could do a third of the volume that you usually do, and you'd be able to maintain your muscle mass, right? So if you did, let's say, 12 sets of chest per week, then you could essentially do just 4 sets and you'd be able to maintain your muscle. And I think that's great news because you can fit all that easily into 2 workouts per week if you're away. As long as, again, you're pushing with enough effort and intensity. But there is some research showing that, you know, older populations, they have a little bit of a harder time maintaining muscle than younger populations do. So for them, it might be a little bit more. There's definitely more research needed on that front, but we definitely know that for older populations, they have a harder time maintaining muscle, and they likely need a bit more volume to maintain than younger individuals do.
I really like that answer, and it's very affirming for people that when they go away, they can still do what they love, their habit, their hobby of doing exercise, but they can switch off psychologically and enjoy their trip, enjoy their time off, and without having fear that they're going to shrink into oblivion and lose all of their strength. It's very nice that they can play around with that one-third amount of volume, give or take, depending on your age.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
How about tempo with exercises? There's sometimes the school of thought that slower reps are better for building muscle than fast reps.
You know, we do know that the eccentric part of an exercise, it is important for growth. So when it comes to tempo, like, my recommendation is just use a tempo where you're actually controlling the weight down and not letting gravity just drop it down for you, because that's a huge muscle building stimulus. And if you're just letting gravity drop it every single rep, then you're missing out on a lot of muscle growth. In terms of how slow, there is some research on this that shows that you can actually be too slow. I believe it was around anything slower than 5 seconds of an eccentric was just a little bit too slow. And mainly because the amount of load that you could lift with a 5 second eccentric would be significantly lower than with a relatively faster tempo. So I think there's plenty of flexibility and it comes down to personal preference, but I would definitely prioritize, you know, using an eccentric where you're actually actively controlling that weight down and feeling that muscle stretch all the way down. And then on the way up, I would think, you know, anything that is, again, not too slow, you're controlling the weight up, and generally that would probably be somewhere between 1 to 2 seconds on the concentric.
Also, I believe the ongoing challenge of controlled tempo is applying that as you progress. I think when we start out with a routine, it's at a level of difficulty where we can control every single eccentric. But what I often find people fall into the trap to, I'll admit, me too, is when you're chasing performance improvements on paper, your final reps in a set don't look like the first ones, in respect of you start really like dive bombing through your eccentrics. And as you said, that's an important part of, I guess, milking out the hypertrophy stimulus from every single rep. So I'll just say that I agree. I always teach a controlled tempo, but having that as a constant throughout your training program is key to know that you're actually progressing. And I feel that this is where that whole mindfulness of really being present when you're training and trying to make each rep count instead of going through the motions and getting sloppy with your tempo can be a big difference in the results you get.
No, for sure. And that's kind of like, you got stronger on paper, but did your muscles actually get stronger? You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I did more reps or I lifted more weight, but oh, my eccentrics went from control to just letting gravity drop it down. So yeah, I think it's definitely something to be mindful of. And yeah, as you noted, like, tempo will slow down and should slow down towards the end of your set as the rep gets harder and harder. That's a good sign that you're reaching muscular failure.
With regard to technique on exercises, there's this idea that if you change your foot position, you can target different muscles. If you change the angle of your arm, you can target different heads of a muscle. Is there any truth to this?
There is actually, you know, quite a bit of truth with that. Like, for example, with the biceps, if you were to hold, you know, a pair of dumbbells and you were to externally rotate your shoulders a little bit, then that would activate a little bit more of the long head, and vice versa if you were to internally rotate. And it's funny because it's actually the opposite if you're holding onto a barbell. If you use a narrow grip, then your actual intent is external rotation as you're coming up. So that would favor a little bit more of the long head, whereas the opposite for the wide grip. So yes, long story short, like, there's definitely like a bunch of techniques that you can use to favor different heads of a muscle. And sometimes different heads of a muscle performs a different function, like the case earlier that I mentioned about the hamstrings. Some of them will preferentially extend the hip, whereas the others will flexing the knee. So in that case, you can, you know, quote unquote, emphasize some heads of a muscle more than the other heads. But the real question is, like, does this actually matter? I think in most cases, like, it definitely just overcomplicates things more than they should be. Like, people just get way too way too obsessive over, like, I need to do this exercise to target this head and then this one to target this head. And like at the end of the day, like, if you're choosing a good, you know, a variety of exercises, that's going to cover, you know, pretty much everything, and you don't need to worry about like the itty-gritty details. I do think it's really interesting, but do I think it actually has like a lot of practicality and will make a huge difference in people's results? Probably not.
Yeah, because some bodybuilders absolutely swear by a different foot position on calf raises will preferentially target the lateral gastroc or the medial gastroc. Or if you're doing a leg extension, if you point your leg inward, it's going to target the outer side of the quadricep vastus lateralis. Or if you point it inward, you're going to get more VMO. And I feel that what you said hit the nail on the head, that it's just the minutiae. These are the really small details. What you should be worried about is the effort relative to failure. Can you feel it like globally in that muscle group? And just matching this up with, if someone says, hey man, you need to do this to grow this part of your muscle, but it causes you joint pain and you don't feel it in the muscle that you're trying to target because it doesn't suit your anthropometry or your build, this is where you got to step back and be like, okay, I want to grow my calves. I'm going to do calf raises in a way that I can feel the muscle, or leg extensions, I think, is most important.
And I mean, that being said, if I was a top level pro bodybuilder, by all means, I would obsess over those little details because they actually matter. But for somebody who's like, you know, a beginner or novice in the gym, like I think they're overthinking the details and really just need to focus on the basics.
We've discussed a fair bit in this podcast about the idea of training to failure. Is training to failure necessary for muscle growth?
So it's definitely not necessary, but you definitely need to come close enough to it in order to maximize growth. And based on the research that we do have, it seems like at least within 3 reps short of Baylor, it's a sweet spot to aim for. But I do think there is definitely benefit to occasionally taking your sets to failure, but it also depends on the exercise. Some exercises are just not safe to take to failure, such as barbell squats, and some exercises are, on the same note, they're a lot more fatiguing to take to failure than others. For example, isolation exercises, these are relatively safe and not as fatiguing as compound exercises to take to failure, so you can take those to failure more often. And going to failure compared to stopping, you know, a few reps shy of failure does seem to provide a little bit more growth, but you just have to always be wary of that little bit more growth comes with disproportionately more fatigue. So it's all about that balance. And I will say that there is some new research that is coming out that seems to imply that going to failure, or at least, you know, very, very close to it, is actually a lot more important than we realize. So I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, in the next few years, we see some new studies showing the importance of failure, of going to actual true failure, is a lot more important for growth than we once thought. But I do think at the end of the day, there's always going to be that balance, because you can't take every single set of every single workout to failure and recover from it.
I find this topic of failure absolutely fascinating, because we can talk about this conceptually and be like, yep, 1 to 3 reps from failure, sometimes going to failure is good. But when we look around in the real world, you guys know when you're at the gym between rest periods, you look around at the level of exertion, rep speed isn't slowing down. People could do sometimes 5 or 10 reps more per set to even get within 1 to 3 reps of failure. And the whole idea as well of not all failure is created equal. Are we talking about technical failure? Are we talking about volitional muscular failure? These terms, I feel, moving forward in fitness are going to be more clearly defined, so we understand what failure actually means, depending on the context, and what we should be doing from a consistent effort basis relative to failure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For sure.
You are quite the expert when it comes to the topic of posture, in the sense that since you've started your YouTube channel, Jeremy, you have absolutely taken the world by storm on the topic of posture. What have you learned researching the topic of posture and what are your best recommendations for posture in general?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to posture, there's a lot of nuance that goes into it. I think generally people are a lot more concerned with their posture than they should be. And I think that the link to, you know, bad posture and pain and injury, in the research, like it's not very well correlated. That being said, I think that lack of movement and inactivity throughout the day is definitely something that people should be concerned about and is, you know, associated with adverse health outcomes. And, you know, nobody feels good if you're locked into, you know, a slouched over posture for literally hours and hours on end every single day. So I think that's where, you know, mobility exercises to open you up and just introduce more movement throughout the day, that's where those become extremely helpful. And oftentimes, you know, once your body does get used to certain positions, it can make it difficult for you to be able to execute certain exercises in the gym properly and to use a full range of motion during those exercises. For example, you know, a bench press, if I'm really locked into this forward posture, it's going to make it a lot harder to engage my pecs. So, you know, maybe doing something in your warm up that helps open up your chest can be really beneficial to do before that. But yeah, I think like posture is a tricky topic, and people generally are a lot more concerned with it than they should be. And at the end of the day, like if you just simply introduce more movement, walking and just exercises you enjoy throughout the day to break up long periods of sitting, that would solve like 90% of the issues that they experience.
For sure. And being a physiotherapist myself, the amount of misconceptions I hear from the general public pertaining to posture is just simply unfounded. And I feel that a lot of this kind of fear-based language of if you sit like this or look like this with a objective posture, that it's going to do your body harm, is doing people more disservice than it is helping them. And I feel that our job as fitness professionals or rehab specialists is to really get this idea out there that your body is strong, it is robust, it is adaptable. And this presentation of a posture isn't the full picture. It's one static position. It doesn't represent your muscular strength. It doesn't represent how much muscle mass you've got in your body. It doesn't represent your cardiorespiratory fitness. And I think that it's placing too much weight on appearance as opposed to what is functionally happening under the hood.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly.
You've spoken to a few rehab experts over the years, such as Dr. Stuart McGill. What are the biggest lessons that you've learned about pain, injury, and performance?
Stuart McGill is awesome, dude. Like, I don't know if you've ever spoken with him, but he's just like such a pleasure to speak with because he's just a wealth of knowledge and just like a really cool dude. And he's taught me a lot. Like, we've done a couple collaborations so far, and I've read a few of his books. I'm not sure if you've read any of his books, but I think like generally what I've learned from him is, it is very individual. There's no like one, I don't know, back fixing routine that you can prescribe to everybody. Like, it's a very case by case basis. And as much as he's tried to, you know, solve for that with the solutions that he has, it still is at the end of the day very individual. And I think one of the things that I've come to appreciate from him is like it really comes down to the basics again, which is, you know, being mindful of your back position, making sure you're, you know, getting enough activity throughout the day, and then also just letting that you know, avoiding positions that cause pain to whatever injury that you have. So it really does come down to the basics. And yeah, I think like it's the individual aspect of it as well. And that's what kind of makes our jobs as content creators so difficult, because there's, you know, oftentimes there's so many like nuances and case by case things that it makes it difficult to make one piece of content that can cater to everybody or even provide a recommendation that's like, okay, yeah, do this. You know what I mean?
For sure. And an idea that goes against conventional thinking from the public is that if you have an injury in a certain movement pattern, such as you hurt your back bending over, the idea that you should always avoid that movement pattern is just simply not true. The best thing that you can do is scaled load progression in that movement pattern that previously caused you harm. So it's not unusual to expose patients or people that have experienced pain or injury to the movement pattern that caused them pain in a way which they can tolerate and improve over time to make their tissues more adapt. And I feel that if we embrace this idea of doing that sensibly under the guidance of a professional, what used to cause you pain, what movements used to scare you, you will have the capacity to handle those. And the confidence that comes from being able to tolerate positions of pain through progression is a powerful thing.
Right. And on that note, I think another thing that he's really taught me is that, like, if you do have an injury, like, it doesn't mean you're just going to sit on bed all day. Like, you have to train around that injury, and that's part of the recovery process. And there's always something that you can do.
For sure. Jeremy Etier, ladies and gentlemen, where can people find out more about your work?
Yeah, so you can head over to my YouTube channel. That's where I put most of my effort, and it's just my name, Jeremy. It's actually Jeremy Etier, last name.
Excuse me, sorry.
No, it's all good. Everybody says Etier. It's hilarious. I'm used to it.
I specifically tried to pronounce your name correctly, and I've failed miserably in the last few minutes, so I apologize.
No, it's French, and apparently the real way to say it is like Etsy or something. But I just...
All right, so even you couldn't pronounce it right.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So don't blame me. But yeah, you can head over to my YouTube channel, and then we also publish, you know, updated content on bitwithscience.com, and that's also where we take all our research and we create fitness plans that are, you know, individualized for that person. So that's where you can find me. And yeah, thank you, Daniel. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I've looked up to you for many years, and I still enjoy the content that you put out.
My pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for your time. If you enjoyed that, click here for another value-packed fitness FAQs video. Peace.